So this morning we're continuing our series in looking at Moses and looking at the life of Moses and particularly his leadership of the Israelites and what that has to say into our lives and our situations and our journey of faith today. And this morning we are in Exodus chapter 15, verse 1 to 21, and so I'd like to just read it out to you now. Then Moses and the Israelites sang this song to the Lord. I will sing to the Lord. By the way, I'm not going to sing it. I'm sorry. I'm just going to speak it out. I will sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted, both horse and driver. He is hurled into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my defense. He has become my salvation. He is my God and I will praise him. My father's God and I will exalt him. The Lord is a warrior. The Lord is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his army is hurled into the sea. The best of Pharaoh's officers are drowned in the Red Sea. The deep waters have covered them and they sank to the depths like a stone. Your right hand, Lord, was majestic in power. Your right hand, Lord, shattered the enemy. In the greatness of your majesty, you threw down those who opposed you. You unleashed your burning anger and it consumed them like stubble. By the blast of your nostrils, the waters piled up. The surging waters stood up like a wall. The deep waters congealed in the heart of the sea. The enemy boasted, I will pursue, I will overtake them. I will divide the spoils. I will gorge myself on them. I will draw my sword and my hand will destroy them. But you blew with your breath and the sea covered them. They sank like lead in the mighty waters. Who among the gods is like you, Lord? Who is like you? Majestic in holiness, awesome in glory, working wonders. You stretch out your right hand and the earth swallows your enemies. In your unfailing love you will lead the people you have redeemed. In your strength you will guide them to your holy dwelling. The nations will hear and tremble. Anguish will grip the people of Philistia. The chiefs of Edom will be terrified. The leaders of Moab will be seized with trembling. The people of Canaan will melt away. Terror and dread will fall on them. But by the power of your arm, they will be as still as stone. Until your people pass by, Lord. Until the people you brought pass by. We will bring them in and plant them on the mountain of your inheritance, the place, Lord, you made for your dwelling, the sanctuary, Lord, your hands established. The Lord reigns forever and ever. And when Pharaoh's horses and chariots and horsemen went into the sea, the Lord brought the waters of the sea back over them. But the Israelites walked through the sea on dry ground. And then Miriam the prophet, Aaron's sister, took a timbrel in her hand, and all the women followed her with timbrels and dancing. And Miriam sang to them, sing to the Lord, for he is highly exalted. Both horse and driver, he is hurled into the sea. Now, in just over 2 weeks' time, I'm heading over to the USA on a trip of almost 3 weeks, 2.5 weeks, on a leadership study tour. A group of Church of Christ ministers, there's 14 of us in total, are going, and we're going to have a look at a whole lot of churches in the southwest of America, California and Arizona. And it's great. I'm looking forward to this trip very much. I'm getting quite excited about it. But it's fair to say that before this opportunity came up, I'd never been to America before, and I had no desire to go. It's just because of the opportunity that came up that I thought, yeah, this is a good opportunity. It's a good chance to get away. Let's go. And then as a result of that, I've started thinking about what America's going to be like and started imagining what's it going to be like to be in America, to go and visit this country. And maybe it's just the way I've wired, but I thought, well, I need to learn about America. I need to learn its history. I need to learn a bit more about its people. And so I've started doing a lot of reading and research on the American people just to get a sense of the people that I'm going to be interacting with and some of who they are and where they've been and all that sort of stuff. And it's interesting in my reading and research that I've done, I've picked up quite a few negative stereotypes of Americans. Some of the things that I've read and I've researched talk about Americans being, you know, really into the largesse. You know, they're very big people. You know, they're physically quite large at times, and they like big things, big buildings, big cars, big everything. And another stereotype is that they can be somewhat arrogant at times, that they're naive of other nations and people groups, and they can come across as arrogant. And another stereotype is around how they can be a bit militarily interventionist and somewhat dominant and all of those things. But in my reading and research, I've also picked up a number of positive stereotypes about American people. They're a very generous people, incredibly hospitable. Over the last 100 years or so, they've demonstrated global leadership. They're friendly, they're open, they've been at the forefront of many technological and industrial advancements that have changed our world significantly for the better. But there's one particular positive aspect of American people that I just want to pick up and dwell on a bit today. And that is that they have a great sense of optimism. They're positive. They are cup half full people. And out of this positivity, out of this optimism, comes this great sense of innovative ability. And all through history, especially the last 100 years or so, they've set for themselves these unreachable goals, and then they've gone out and achieved them. Now, arguably, this sense of optimism and positivity that I've come across as I've studied American people is their greatest strength. At least that is what I think it is. Now, I'm really looking forward to, in 2.5 weeks' time, to spending a whole lot of time with American people that are positive and that are natural optimists. I'm actually hoping that some of this optimism that they have rubs off a bit on me. Because as Australians, we're quite different to this, aren't we? Our culture is quite different. I mean, as Australians, our culture has been birthed in hardship. First white settlement were convict settlements. And then we had the pioneer settlements of going out into harsh lands and struggling to get going and get established. And then there was the gold mining era, and there was a lot of hardship associated with that. And then the challenges as we settled and decided to become farmers, and we started farming what is a very dry and arid land. And then as you go on, you look at the impact of things like the Depression and then the two world wars. Australians have sort of, their culture has been framed in to some degree, in suffering and hardship. And so as a result, I think we're a people that are much less prone to optimism. You know, the typical Australian thing, you know, talk out of the side of your mouth. How's the weather been? I mean, it can't make up its mind. It's ridiculous. You know, we're very good at articulating all that's wrong with the world. You know, like, what about those people in Canberra? They've got no idea. Gee, it'd be good to one day get into a restaurant and actually get good service, wouldn't it? I look forward to the day where maybe I'll ring up a tradesperson and they'll actually turn up when they say they will. I think Australians are somewhat more cup half empty people. You know, we're very good at complaining, aren't we, about grumbling. And today, as we continue our series in Moses, what we discover, and we see it for the first time in a passage which I'm about to share, is that the Israelites were very good at complaining and very good at grumbling. But where we are here in Exodus chapter 15, we're in the spot where just last week, when we were in Exodus chapter 14, we looked at the parting of the Red Sea. This great miracle that would happen. How God defeated the Israelite army and the Egyptian army, and how the Israelites, they're now free to walk as free people. They're on their way to the land that's been promised with them, a land that's flowing with milk and honey. All's good. And in Exodus chapter 15, the first 21 verses that I read out just before, what we see is this great sense of optimism and hope. Verse 2. The Lord is my strength and my defense. In verse 11, who among the gods is like you, Lord? Who is majestic in holiness, awesome in glory, working in wonders? Verse 12, you stretch out your right hand and the earth swallows your enemy. Verse 13, in your unfailing love, you will lead the people you have redeemed. There's so much positivity in Exodus chapter 15, the first 21 verses. So much optimism. And we see it as it finishes. You know, we've got Miriam, Moses' and Aaron's sister, and she gets her timbrel out. I'm assuming that's some sort of thing that you shake. Might not be. I didn't look that up. Anyway, she's got the timbrel out, and she starts dancing. I can't do that. I noticed some people dancing in the foyer on the way in this morning. That was a bit special. But they're dancing and they're praising God, and we've got this all in. You know, we're talking about 2 million Egyptians here, so we can assume that there's hundreds of thousands of women, and they're following Miriam around, dancing, all in, dancing, singing, praise session to God, and it's just going off. Fantastic. Look what God has done, they say. He's rescued us. We're his special chosen people. We're blessed. And then within 3 days of this moment, their mood completely changes. Verse 22 to 24, it's going to be up on the screen. Let's have a look. Moses then led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went into the desert of Shur. And for 3 days they traveled in the desert without finding water. And when they came to Marah, they could not drink its water because it was bitter. And that's why the place is called Marah. So the people grumbled against Moses, and they're saying, what are we to drink? Now, I've got a little bit of sympathy for the Israelites here. I mean, if any of us had to walk around the desert for 3 days without getting a drink of water, I think we'd be pretty parched, and we'd probably start to complain a little bit ourselves, fair to say. But God is doing something here, and what he's doing is he wants to take the Israelites even deeper into their understanding of who he is and how he works. Let's have a look at what happens next. It's going to be up on the screen, verse 25 to 27. And then Moses cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a piece of wood. He threw it in the water, and the water became fit to drink. And there the Lord issued a ruling and instruction for them and put them to the test. He said, if you listen carefully to the Lord your God and do what is right in his eyes, if you pay attention to his commands and keep all of his decrees, I will not bring on you any of the diseases I brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you. And then they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs and 70 palm trees, and they camped there near the water. Now God is teaching the Israelites here that they have to trust in him. That they have to rely on him, no matter what the circumstances. In both the good and the bad. When they're in the desert and they're absolutely parched, they still have to trust. And when they're relaxing under palm trees by a freshwater spring, they still have to trust. He's teaching them to follow him wherever he leads them, even when it doesn't make sense. He's teaching them to wait patiently on him for his provision and his blessing, because no matter what the circumstances they faced, no matter what circumstances we face, God is in control. So what we see here in Exodus chapter 15 is a bit of a cycle, and it's a cycle that's going to be repeated for the next 40 years for the Israelites and even beyond that. It's a cycle that goes something like this, and you'll see it on the screen behind me. First part of the cycle is abundance. I mean, look what God's done here. He's parted the Red Sea. Amazing. It's a miracle. It's incredible. The next part of the cycle is expectation. God's going to keep blessing us. No matter what, the Red Sea miracles, they're just going to keep rolling on and continue. And then the next part of the cycle is disappointment. These are unmet expectations of God. And hang on, 3 days, no water? We're getting thirsty here, God. And then that leads to grumbling, complaining. What are we to drink? And then the cycle goes back to where it started. We've got the miracle at Marah, and then the abundance at Elim, God's provision. It's a cycle that kept going through the next 40 years of Israelite history. It's a cycle that kept going, in fact, through their entire history. Perhaps it's even a cycle that happens in our own lives. What we find is that throughout the whole Exodus story from this point onwards is that the Israelites became known, unfortunately, for their grumbling and their complaining. Even in the midst of great miracles, they became cup half empty people. Too often they lacked trust in God. Too often they resorted to complaining instead of praising. Now this week, as I was preparing this message, I came across a website. It was a website called theirritablemail.com. And on this website, you could do a test to determine whether you were a grumpy male or not. And I thought, well, I'm going to do this test and I'm going to pass with flying colours because there's no way I'm a grumpy person. So I did the test on theirritablemail.com and I wasn't very happy with some of the results, it's fair to say. And I thought, this test must be wrong. I'm not a grumpy person. I mean, the only time I ever get grumpy is when I have to take a test on whether I'm grumpy or not, and it comes back and tells me that I'm grumpy. Now, all jokes aside, this is actually a bit of a challenge for me. And dare I say it, it's possibly a challenge for many of us. You see, whether it's grumbling or complaining, irritability, anger, whatever it is, there's these negative emotions that can well up and sometimes they can just overwhelm us. They rob us of our joy, our peace. They rob us from being able to embrace all that life has to offer us. And these negative emotions also affect those around us. You see, it's hard work living with a grumpy person. Kate, is it? No. Romans chapter 8, verse 15 says this on screen, and be up on the screen. May the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace as you trust in him, so that you may overflow with hope by the power of the Holy Spirit. Now, does anyone else read verses such as this and look at it and go, yep, that's great? Not quite there. It's not quite my reality, actually. The overflowing of joy and hope and peace, it's not actually always my experience. And as I was thinking about this week, I started thinking, well, what is it that we need to do in order to more fully experience the reality of this passage? And I thought about the Israelites and I thought, well, perhaps it's not so much what we can learn from them in terms of what they did, it's what we can learn from them in terms of what they failed to do. And today there's three areas that I think we can learn from them. The first one is that they complained in the wrong way. They complained in the wrong way. See, throughout Exodus and throughout other books of the Bible, the Israelites seemed to complain a lot. And God grew weary of their complaints after time. In Numbers chapter 14, verse 26 to 27, it says, "And the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, how long shall this wicked community complain about me?" And in that passage, he would go on to say that the next generation of Israelites would be the ones that would enter the promised land, that they would then have to wander around the desert for 40 years because they could actually enter in. And any person that was alive at that particular time that was aged 20 or over, they would die before the Israelites entered the promised land. God just got sick of it. Got sick of the whinging and the complaining. And he said, I've got to start something new and something afresh here with the Israelites. And so the Israelites of Moses' era became known, in a way, for their complaining and their grumbling. And yet, elsewhere in the Bible, particularly in Psalms, we can see the writers of Psalms, in some instances, actually really complaining to God. And so you'd wonder, what's going on here? So, for example, Psalm 137 talks about sorrow. Psalm 140 talks about my anger. Psalm 69 talks about fear. Psalm 85 talks about longing. Psalm 102 talks about confusion. Psalm 22 talks about desolation. Psalm 74 about disappointment. Psalm 88 about depression. This is just to name a few. Over 70 psalms of the 150 psalms are basically whinges to God. And you know, there's one really important difference between the psalmist's complaints to God and between that which we observe in the Israelites under Moses. And the difference is this. Every single psalm that I've just quoted, every single psalm of the 70-odd that are whinges and complaints to God, they either start and or they finish with a statement of trust. Psalm 88 verse 1. Lord, you are the God who saves me. Go and read it later. The rest of it is about, woe is my life, how bad it is. And yet, it starts with, Lord, you are the God who saves me. You see, it's actually okay to complain to God. Don't worry about complaining to God. He's big enough to handle it. He doesn't mind so much. But don't be like the Israelites. Don't stop trusting. Because God is near. God protects. God rescues. God provides. God wins the battles that we face. The Israelites just complained in the wrong way. The second thing that they did, which was wrong, was that they kept forgetting what God had done for them. The Israelites had fallen into this bad habit of forgetting. I mean, it was even just a few days after they'd seen this amazing miracle of the Red Sea parting, 3 days later, and they're forgetting and they're complaining and they're grumbling. May God help us not to forget that which He has done for us. You know, one of the key ways I think for us not to forget what God has done is to make time each day to remember. To remember Him, even in the minute details of the day. At the Gisborne Connect group, which we've had going now for 7 weeks in total, it's been going really well. And one of the things we did a couple of weeks ago as a little exercise for those that are part of the Gisborne Connect group is that throughout the week we had to take a photo. And it was a photo that represents something that we were grateful for. And then on our phones, we brought it the next week and we could actually talk about the photo and talk about what, you know, why we were grateful to God and give some specific examples. Now, I've got a photo which is going to be up on the screen. This is the photo that I took that I shared. Now, I don't know how... It's not too bad. It's not actually a great photo. I'm not an amazing photographer. But this was a moment where I really sense God's presence. This is a photo of my backyard, sitting down there on my back deck, looking out to my backyard. Now, this was a morning 3 weeks ago. It was quite a cold morning, but the sun was starting to just melt down on me. And I was experiencing the warmth of the sun. It was really lovely. And then I could look out on this garden. And this garden that sort of over the last 5 or 6 years Kate and I have created with our own hands, but really the sense has been that God's hands has been leading our hands, because it's God that makes the plants grow and God that gives the sunshine and the rain and all of those things. And so there was a real sense of admiring and being grateful to God for that which He'd been provided to us in our garden. I was grateful for a home that provides us with shelter and warmth and a sense of place and belonging. Grateful for a family who live in that home, who even at a young ages, I mean, Kate and I are still young kids, loving family, mostly. And as I started thinking and reflecting on these things within me, this extreme sense of gratitude just welled up to God. And my heart became joyful. I became joyful as I remembered what it is that God has done for me, even in the minutiae of life. The Israelites kept forgetting what God had done for them, and they also lost sight of who they were in God. They lost sight of who they were in God. Next slide. Thanks, Neil. Now, my youngest daughter, who's six, she's a quality time girl. She just likes to, you know, be with you. She likes snuggles, all that sort of stuff, and that's just really delightful. This week, when I was dropping her off at school, it was a Tuesday morning, I was dropping her off, and she said to me, as we're walking through the school gate, "Dad, when I get home, I want to sit out on the back deck with you," which is, I've just shown you in that photo. "I want to sit out on the back deck with you so I can tell you all about my day." Now, yeah, it melts your heart as a father. And of course, I agreed straight away and said, "Darling, that's wonderful. I look forward to doing that with you." And Tuesday was sermon prep day and other prep and that sort of stuff. And so I'm sitting at home working away, and all day my heart's just filled with joy as I look forward to this moment where I could sit with my daughter and she could tell me all about her day. And from time to time, as parents, we experience that joy, don't we? That joy of our children, of just wanting to be with us and connect with us. It's a really lovely thing. And that joy that as parents we experience from time to time, it actually speaks to a greater joy that God the Father experiences in us. In Zephaniah 3:17 it says, "The Lord your God is in your midst, a mighty one who will save. He will rejoice over you with gladness. He will quiet you by his love. And he will exult over you with loud singing." That's a beautiful picture, isn't it? This idea that God exults over us with loud singing. I'm sure it sounds amazing. He will rejoice over us with gladness. You know, so often we have this idea of God as someone who's somewhat distant or hard to access, or maybe we're not worthy or whatever it is. And yet he rejoices over us so much. You see, the Israelites got this wrong because they kept on returning to this mentality of slavery. They kept on going back to this mindset of harshness, of unjust punishment, to where a king would always have his foot on their throats. And yet in their new king, their father God, they had one who rescues, who provides, who loves, who delights in them. They needed to shift their mindset. You see, we talk about grumbling and complaining, and we can sort of have a bit of fun with that, and we can make mirth of that because, you know, hey, it's part of being an Aussie. It's just part of who I am. I talk out of the corner of my mouth. Yeah, we do that, don't we? And we sort of make light of it and make fun, but there's a reality in that, that as we embrace a complaining posture, we lose something too. And we lose a sense of God's joy, of the life that's possible and available in him. And if you're here today and you would like to move away maybe from grumbling and complaining and more towards finding his joy, if you would like to make that movement, then I want to encourage you today that this will happen as we fix our eyes on him. As we remember what it is that he's done for us. As we remember who we are in him. Now, one last slide on the screen from Snoopy. You see, the secret of life is just looking up. You see, whenever I'm facing challenging circumstances, the temptation is to start doing this. Look down at the navel, become introverted and introspective and worry and stress and focus on the problem and the issue. And yet, to be able to find God's joy even in the midst of difficult circumstances The only way to look is up. To get our eyes on Jesus. And if you want to make that shift from grumbling to joy, the best way that I've found to do this is through gratitude and praise.